Good morning, everyone. It is November 1st, 2021, All Saints Day, the anniversary of the Lisbon earthquake. What a weekend we had up here in the Adirondacks. Let me tell you, if you've never had a dozen sixth graders jumping up and down on your porch, singing, or rather screaming, Olivia Rodrigo songs, Traitor, Driver's License, if you've never had that, then have you really ever had Halloween? I don't know. Yeah, probably you have. Halloween comes in many shapes and forms, and it is a great, great holiday. It's great for the kids, great for the old folks, great for watching Hubie Halloween on Netflix with your cousins across the country. So many super things about Halloween. If you have not seen Hubie Halloween, do yourself a favor. One of the modern classics, right up there with Curious George's Halloween Boo Fest. Definitely go out and check out Hubie Halloween. If you're a fan of movies like Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, and let's face it, if you're not a fan of Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, then I don't know. You know, you got to find some appreciation out there. These are hilarious movies. Appreciate the highbrow stuff too. But if you can't appreciate the lowbrow stuff, I feel bad for you. You got to appreciate everything. Highbrow, lowbrow, middlebrow. This is a big tent. All brows are welcome here on the ADK Homeroom Podcast. Let's get into it. A little more highbrow stuff than classic Adam Sandler here. We've got, ironically, one of Adam Sandler's highest brow things, by the way, was his song about Elmo. If you haven't listened to his Elmo song, go listen to that one. All right. Today, we are discussing the top seven arguments against libertarianism and how to counter them or what's wrong with them. Let's get right into it. The first argument that people always make against libertarianism is externalities, negative externalities, right? If you're going to have a laissez-faire system, then people say, oh, but what about the negative externalities? They're going to ruin life for everyone. So that's why you can't have libertarian economics, they say. First of all, what is an externality? Of course, an externality exists when a third party is impacted by some transaction between two other parties, or maybe it's just a single party is impacted by something that somebody else is doing. For example, maybe an electricity company is generating electricity, selling the electricity to their customers, but the way they generate it is burning fossil fuels, and that fossil fuel combustion is dumping waste into the atmosphere, and a person two states away is then affected by this because his air quality is worse, right? So that would be a negative externality imposed by the electricity industry on a person living two states away. Maybe you could also say, right, back in the day when we had these aerosol cans with CFCs in them, right, chlorofluorocarbons, and you buy your spray paint, you go out and you spray paint Go Blue Wolverines on your garage. Yeah, pretty sad weekend for the Wolverines. Oh well, you spray paint on there, but alas, you have now released some chlorofluorocarbons into the atmosphere. They're going up into the upper atmosphere, breaking down the ozone, enlarging the ozone layer, and worsening the quality of life for everybody on the planet. That would be a negative externality, right? Because what are you doing? All you're doing is spray painting. Nothing wrong with spray painting, but the externality is the release of these chemicals into the atmosphere, right? And that hurts everybody. Well, look, the argument here against this is pretty easy. The argument against this is that if you think there's a problem with externalities, then you find the rights that are being violated and you punish the person who is violating their rights, right? If you got somebody in your neighborhood burning some poisonous incense that drifts into your yard and kills your pet bearded dragon, that's assault. That's an externality, but that is a violation of your property rights, and you need to go find that person, and they need to be held accountable. by the justice system, right? If you're near a train in the train company, or maybe Amtrak, right? Governments are not immune to causing negative externalities. So Amtrak is vibrating your house and shaking it down to a ground. That's a violation of noise ordinances. That's a violation of your property rights, your right to be free from interference with your property. And people talk about secondhand smoke, exactly the same thing. So that's the issue with externalities. They're always identifiable as a violation of somebody's rights. If somebody's rights are not being violated, if you're not worsening the quality of life for somebody else, if you're not damaging their life, damaging their property, not harming them, then it's not an issue. And if they are getting damaged, property, life, anything like any right is human right, natural right is being infringed on, whether the government recognizes it or not, we're not talking about legal rights. If any of these rights are being infringed on, then you find the violator and you hold them accountable. This is not a problem with the economic system. This is a problem with the justice system. If those people are not being held accountable, and let's face it, right now they're not, right? You've got people all over just dumping their pollution into the air, dumping their pollution into the water. That is a problem for sure. But it's not a market problem. It's a justice system problem. Right? The justice system's responsibility is to punish people for violating somebody else's rights. The justice system's responsibility is to protect everybody's rights. Now, is it hard? Yeah, it's awfully hard to figure out the right judicial system to punish people who are dumping stuff into the atmosphere and who are polluting the rivers and who are committing other even more subtle forms of destruction, right? Deteriorating our environment. But just because it's hard doesn't mean that you resort to some blunt, wrong, misguided attempt to eliminate everything, right? You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You don't say that, this is too hard, so I can't do it. Right? No, you have to keep going. That's why law schools are important. That's why jurisprudence is important. We're not done with discovering the best way to order society. Far from it, right? We're not done with our legal system. This isn't chemistry, right? We know chemistry. Chemistry is done, okay? Absolutely, chemistry is done. That's why they had to steal from physics, right? They took nuclear chemistry. All of a sudden, nuclear physics, oh, that's a chemistry subject now. Okay, fine, just because you finished everything with your subject, fine. So, okay, I'm being a little unfair. There are some corner cases, but let's face it, most of chemistry is dead and done. But the legal system is not like that. The judicial system is not like that. The justice system has tons of room to improve, and that needs to happen. Right? Remember, civilization has been a process of recognizing more and more of these individual rights. Savages, like the Native Americans who were here before Europeans arrived here, they had no conception of property rights, no conception of land rights, right? They had to develop these. They had never discovered these. They had to learn these from people coming in. The idea of having a right to land, this is new technology, and we need to develop that new technology for air, for water, for noise rights. These sort of external problems are definitely problems, but they need to be addressed not by banning free markets, not by banning the system that has lifted untold millions out of poverty. 50,000 people lifted out of abject poverty every single day for the last half century, three quarters of a century. We don't abandon these liberal principles because we're running into externality problems. We address the violations of rights, which are the problems with these external consequences, with these negative externalities. Right? Yeah, and you have to be careful, right? Because not every negative externality is a violation of rights. Let me give you an example. You've got a house. Maybe you've got a house, it's bought in the section of town that was one of the first developed sections of town. Maybe your house is a Victorian, maybe something like that. Maybe it's a mid-century modern, and it's built with kind of old technology. You've got some built-in cabinets for giant cathode ray TV sets. Maybe you got some inefficient heating system in there. Maybe the style is outdated. And then guess what? Somebody, maybe a little bit further out from town, maybe in town in an urban renewal project, who knows? But then somebody else starts building new houses. And these new houses have better heating systems. They have better insulation. They have a fancier style. They have more efficient use of space. Now let's think. Maybe that new invention, that new innovation in housing technology, causes the value of your house to go down. Okay. Maybe it just causes the value of your house not to appreciate as much as it otherwise would. Okay. That's a negative externality associated with these guys off the way building their new awesome houses. Negative externality, it's affecting you negatively with your old house. But you know what? Sorry, that's not a violation of your rights. You do not have a right to an increasing value house. You do not have a right to an exclusive real estate market. In fact, you don't have rights to things, or I should say you don't have freedoms to things. You don't have freedom to an exclusive housing market. You should always formulate your freedoms as freedoms from something else. You have freedom from the right to freedom from people interfering, right, with your house. And them doing something by themselves over another part of town, sure, it could have negative external effect on you, but it is not a violation of your rights. So just be careful there. That's the number one argument against libertarianism, is externalities. And the way to counter it is simply to point out that whenever somebody brings up an externality, the problem with it is that it's a violation of rights. And if it's not a violation of somebody else's rights, then it doesn't need to be worried about. Or perhaps it needs to be addressed or considered, but it is not something that justifies going out and seizing someone else's property or interfering with their right to pursue their own happiness. Okay, let's go on to number two argument against libertarianism that comes up all the time, against libertarian economic policies in particular. And this is the problem of coordination. A lot of people constantly say, oh, there's coordination problems with libertarianism. Coordination's in the economy here. And the counterargument here, not quite as obvious as the counterargument to externalities, because the examples that people give for coordination difficulties are so disparate, right? You could get to the prisoner's dilemma. You could get to the tragedy of the commons. These are the two most common examples of coordination problems that people give out, right? So the prisoner's dilemma, this one is the one where you have two guys in prison. They can't communicate. They can't contract with each other. And they have a choice, right? They're being interrogated, and they could either rat the other guy out or they could stay silent. And if they both stay silent, they each only get 1 year. If one rats the other guy out, then and the other guy stays silent, then the guy who stayed silent gets 5 years, and the guy who ratted out his partner goes free. Or if they both rat each other out, then it's 5 years for both, right? So you go through the arguments here, and you can see that the if you know that your partner is going to stay silent, then the rational thing for you to do is to rat him out so that you're free and he gets 5 years. But in the overall utilitarian view of the outcome, right, that might not be the best, because that's 5 years of prison. Whereas if you had both stayed silent, you both only get 1 year. So they use this argument all the time against libertarianism to show that you need some sort of coordinating government to force both people to stay silent so that there's only 1 year of prison for each of these guys, only a total of 2 years of prison. Whereas in the rational, individually acting scenario, the best you can hope for is that you have 5 years of prison and you could even end up quite possibly with 10 years of prison. All right. So let's tackle this example. The first thing that you say here is this one's easy, right? You let them communicate. I mean, prison is pretty much the antithesis of libertarianism. So you let the guys communicate. You let them be free to make a contract with each other. Specifies the proper penalties. Specifies the damages for breaking the contract. And boom, you've got no more coordination problem. Okay? Libertarianism is really good at being the opposite of prison. So the prisoner's dilemma, that's just the simplest case, obviously, but it's always brought up. And so there you go. There is what you say. You know, you allow contracting, you allow communication. In real life, these are the things. A prison cell where guys are not allowed to communicate, this is a very contrived scenario, right? So that's it. Allow communication, allow contracts, allow damages if contracts are violated, and you have your coordination solved. Again, you do need a functioning legal system. This is not an anarcho, an anarchy podcast. This is a libertarian podcast. You do need some sort of legal system. Now, let's do a little bit more tricky example, more real-world example. Gets to the second big coordination argument that is used against libertarianism. And this would be, let's say, the classic tragedy of commons problem with people fishing in a lake, right? And if they all cooperate on a certain limit, the fish will stay populated. But if the people don't all cooperate, then you have overfishing. And the classic argument proceeds like this on both sides. Well, then you let people form contracts with each other about how much to fish, and if people fish too much, they're penalized. And then the statist comes in and he says, okay, fine, but what about the new guy who comes in? And then the new guy starts fishing in the lake because he hasn't joined the covenant. He's not in on the contract that the initial fish farmers made, so he's not beholden to it. He's a new guy. He arrived, and he's going to fish without having any limits imposed on him by the contract, so he can just suck out of the fish all out of there and make tons of money and then skedaddle out of town. Never mind that skedaddling out of town is not what business owners generally do. That is important, but there's an even easier argument here, right? Then the classic libertarian argument comes back and it says, well, look, as public property, that is true. You have the tragedy of the commons. And if you had private property, then this would all be better. And here's an example, right? You say that this lake is now private property. You allow people to own shares in the lake. You allow people to own private pieces of the lake. You punish them if they pollute other people's pieces of the lake. And then that guy can't fish, not until he buys into the contract. And then at this point, the classic statist comes back and he says, oh, please, there's no way you could get that to work. You can't set up private rights to a lake. This is ridiculous. That's pie in the sky. We just have to, you know, force our limits. We have to decide. We have to put another layer on top of this. The government has to come in and solve this from everybody, because there's no way that you guys could ever possibly work it out amongst yourselves. You know what? That, once again, is this hubris, this arrogance that we have reached the peak of our legal system, that we have reached the peak of our understanding of natural rights and how to allot them, and, well, how to allot property, how to manage natural rights, how to manage property rights. Why would you think that? Why would you think there's no way to improve? The proper way to handle this tragedy of the commons is absolutely not to just say, oh, well, we need to resort to the teacher, the father figure, the authority figure to come in and just start handing out favors, and you can have this many fish certificates, and you can have this many fish certificates, and you can have this many, and we'll form a committee of people who have no idea about fishing, and they'll make the decisions about these fish certificates. That's a completely absurd way to do it. The proper way to do it is to look at it and say, yeah, it is going to be really hard to figure out how to extend our extremely successful idea of land rights and property rights into the waters, into the air, into space, into other planets. It's going to be really hard to do that. But clearly, based on the way history has gone since the dawn of capitalism and the recognition of individual property rights and the elimination of the ruling class gifted by God with some divine right to own land, since the establishment of property rights and land rights as a right of the people, and you have a right to your own life and the product of your own labor, since that establishment, we've advanced tremendously as a society. So why should you stop at air and water and space and noise and heat and all these other difficult concepts just because they're difficult? You don't stop then. You got to be like John Keats. Remember our favorite thing here? Our favorite thing is John Keats talking about negative capability. You have to have that negative capability and keep functioning, keeping your ability to function even when you're not sure of the proper way forward. You keep working at it. You keep functioning even in the midst of confusion. You don't just shut everything down. It's a high school solution to say, oh, we can't do it. Let's just ask the teacher. Let's just appoint somebody to be dictator. That is not the proper way to do it. Now, the other thing here to be careful, so basically to answer the question or to sum up the question again here is the second objection that people have to libertarianism is this problem of coordination. And the two most common examples they give there are the prisoner's dilemma and then something like this fish farm. And you reject the prisoner's dilemma because it's so contrived and it doesn't allow people in the scenario to have freedom. And you reject the tragedy of the commons situation and the coordination system there. You reject that because you say that, oh, well, obviously it is difficult for the private market to coordinate, but simply because it is difficult doesn't mean you stop trying to do it and you don't experiment and you don't find different ways for the private market to do it. It doesn't mean that you just fall back on this primitive solution of electing a chief and having that chief dictate what should happen, because we've seen throughout history the very many poor decisions made by chiefs. Now, the last thing to be careful with this coordination problem is that when people assail libertarianism based on coordination problems, they very, very, very often slip into externality problems, right? They'll start off with global warming and they'll say, or they'll start off with coordination and they'll say, oh, global warming is a coordination problem. We have to have government impose rules on everybody for global warming. And here's what they're going to be. Yeah, no, global warming is an externality problem, right? Someone is committing an action that's damaging somebody else's ability to survive. That is a violation of their rights. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you measure that? How do you protect them? That's a great question. That's a very good question. But that is the question that you need to address. How do you protect them? How do you measure the damage? Those are the questions that you need to address. You need a better conception of air rights and environmental rights. It starts with tackling that question. It doesn't start with banning the issue altogether or just imposing some arbitrary rules by adding an inefficient layer on there that has tremendous costs associated with it. Okay, so that's the coordination thing there. Argument against coordination is to allow more freedom and to find a way to coordinate, not to say, oh, it's too hard to coordinate, so we're just going to give up. Next, the next argument against libertarianism, classic argument against libertarianism, is who will protect the triangle shirtwaist workers? Right? There was this disastrous fire in the Triangle Shirt Factory down in New York City there, and people died. There weren't any good safety precautions in place. The doors were locked. The workers couldn't get out, and it was terrible. It was a tragedy. another way to phrase this objection to libertarian economics is, doesn't a free arena lead to death because you're not protecting people? Well, this is wrong on two counts. The first thing that you have to say on this is that it assumes the government has this perfect knowledge, this infallible ability to actually make things safer just because it intends to, right? People usually assume that, oh, the government wants to make things safer. It can, but really, governments have some of the worst records on mortality in accidents of anybody, and the trend is that the more authoritarian the government, the worse their accidents are, right? You look at China under the Communist Party, they were killing thousands and thousands of people per year in coal mine accidents, for example, over the last, 70 decades, 70 years since the war. And only when the government started allowing more and more freedom to its people did those deaths in the mine accidents in China, coal mine accidents in China, start going down. So do factory fires go away just because the government makes some rules and says, no more factory fires are allowed? Of course not. Of course not. Do condos stop collapsing in Miami just because the government says, oh, you can't collapse a condo in Miami? Absolutely not, as we have seen this year. Do residential towers in London stop going up in flames just because the government has responsibility over the fire codes and the building codes? Absolutely not. We just saw the Grenfell Towers go up in London, go up in flames in London a year or two ago, right? And the government was completely 100% responsible for the fire codes, the building codes, the inspections, and not to mention the fire department that was supposed to come over and put that fire out. So, you could go on and on. Chemical tanks in India stop erupting just because, there weren't, just because the government is in charge of that? Absolutely not. There were rules in place outlawing the Bhopal explosion. The rules are just ineffective. By the way, the Bhopal explosion is really interesting. If you look, there were still protests and controversies going on about that Bhopal explosion. Like in 2006, you can find pictures of people in protests in India in 2006 holding up signs that say things like, "Want Bin Laden? Then give us Anderson." Right, Anderson being the CEO of, I guess, Union Carbide at the time. I think the big company involved there, Union Carbide, not UCIL, the licensee in India, but the one here in America. And so that was still going on in 2006 after the initial explosion in the mid-80s, the early 80s. That was a huge deal. And did it get stopped just because the government took over the safety rules and said no? Of course it did not. Of course it did not. So that's the first problem, is assuming that the government just has this magic fairy dust that they can sprinkle over things. And just because the government says, oh, it's going to stop now, that it automatically stops. No, of course not. So if you're going to get on libertarianism for allowing these disasters, I mean, you have to get on statism at exactly the same rate, which means it's a wash, right? These disasters occur no matter what. In fact, I would argue, of course, that they occur less often in a libertarian world. But the fact remains that they certainly do occur, and at certainly no less of a rate in a world where the government is in charge of safety, or some authority backed by force is in charge of safety. So that argument is a wash. And the second argument, right, against the idea that libertarianism is bad because it won't protect the workers, the second argument, the reason that argument is bad, is because it ignores the benefit side of the equation. Of course, there are disasters that will always occur, as I just pointed out, and that cost is tragic. That is very sad. The benefit side of this argument is that whenever you engage in activity, which by the second law of thermodynamics, there are going to be some entropic results. Whenever you engage in an activity, you can produce wealth. And you will for sure produce some entropic side effects. Second law of thermodynamics, there will be side effects. Some of those will be disastrous. And so just focusing on the disasters would lead you to think, oh, we shouldn't try anything at all. We shouldn't have any factories at all because people die in factories. Well, that's ignoring the great benefit of engaging in activity. Right? You have to get out and do something to make something. Wealth is not a set quantity in this world. You need to generate wealth and generate welfare. How do you do it? Well, it involves action, and action involves entropy. So that's the second problem with this argument that, oh, who will protect the workers? Well, it's impossible to protect workers perfectly because of the second law of thermodynamics. There will always be accidents, and you have to focus on the positives just as much as you focus on the negatives. How many lives are saved by toil and industry in the pharmaceutical industry, in the healthcare industry, in the weapons industry? So many lives are saved. So many lives are made better by those actions. So you got to focus on both sides there. All right. Now, the next two arguments here, we're going to go through fairly quickly because they're really not sophisticated arguments. I'm going to include them here because a lot of people will make them, but they're really not too sophisticated. So the next one, the fourth argument, is sometimes people will say, what about the roads? I mean, this is not a sophisticated argument. Of course, roads will get built. It's pretty silly to say that roads would not get built if you didn't have a overseeing force, an agency that could force other people to do things. You know, look at the internet. Some people will say, oh, it was built by the government. Oh, come on, be serious. I didn't sign up for a DARPA account in 1981. I signed up for a CompuServe account. The internet was private all along. Arrows, BBSs, Barton Trader in Ann Arbor, love that one, AOL. These were private concerns. The internet didn't just magically connect. People worked together, right? If you read Larry Reed's iPencil, again, everybody who's interested in these matters has probably read this, so I won't go into detail about it. But if you're new to these topics, then go read Larry Reed's or Lawrence Reed's iPencil, and it talks about all the coordination issues that markets can overcome if you give them a chance, if you let them develop, if you don't just say, oh, you're not good at doing this, so I have to come in here as the authority figure and force you guys to cooperate. If you let them work together, let them work through it, then things connect. Things get together. The lead for the pencil, the wood for the pencil, the little aluminum or whatever metal they use, or tin or whatever metal they use for the ferrule on the pencil, the rubber for the eraser, all of it somehow magically comes together. Not only that, but it also turns out to be the right size for pencil cases and the right size for people to use with paper and the right softness or hardness of lead for people to use under different conditions with different paper. All of this just works together because people coordinate amongst themselves. And the same thing would happen with roads. Early power companies made it work. Train networks made it work. Yes, the robber barons were quasi-government entities, but still, trains did connect. They were all magically the same size. Well, not magically, it's organically. People find a way to work, right? The electricity companies, you had to match up. People who don't know electricity have no idea the difficulties of matching up electric grid, components on the electric grid, right? You got to have impedance matching. Electric devices have to all be built to work at the same voltages, right? Think of the early phones and phonographs and lights, but it worked. People will cooperate. So saying, what about the roads? That is not a serious objection. Another not serious objection that people sometimes come out with is that libertarian economies leave people out, that the poor get left behind. Now, this is not serious because anybody who carefully looks at the situation sees that, yes, of course, there certainly is a gap between the rich and poor in healthcare, legal access, land holdings, wealth, and a libertarian economy. But they will also, if they're honest, see that the same gap exists in more statist, more socialist economies. And then further, they will see, if they are careful and they are honest, that even the poorest in a libertarian economy are still much better off than if the libertarian economy hadn't accelerated them to this position of crazy riches, right? If we were all libertarian instead of mostly socialist right now, maybe we'd be jaunting around in our secondhand dented suborbital AI-piloted vehicles, and we'd be able to go across the continents in 2 hours, whereas the rich might be able to do it in an hour. Oh, tragedy, such a gap. We can only cross the continent in an hour or in 2 hours, and the rich can cross it in an hour. Oh, this is such a horrible thing. You know, maybe we'd have to only settle for living to 200 and the rich get to live to 300. Oh, I am so wounded by this fact, right? Maybe we'd have to settle for our genetically engineered kids only having a 500% reduced morbidity and mortality rate, while the rich had 700% reduced rate. This is so sad. Maybe I'd only be able to visit Mars twice in my lifetime instead of going back and forth every weekend like the Bezoses could. Do you see my point here, right? It's not about inequality. There will always be inequality. The point is that removing inequality should not be the primary goal or even the secondary goal of the economic system. The primary and secondary goal is creation of wealth and welfare. If your jealousy is preventing you, your covetousness is preventing you from enjoying life, right? If you'd rather be equal with everyone else and you'd rather live in a cave with your kids dying before age 5 over 50% of the time. And remember that up until just 150 years ago, 50% of all children born died before age 5, right? Remember that, please. It's almost unimaginable now. Half of all kids die before age 5 when this country started, right? If you want measles and mumps and new diseases we can't imagine to be affecting everybody, just so that your neighbor doesn't have a nicer cave bear skin than you do, well, then you're pathological. I'm sorry, but you are wrong and you need help, right? There are far more things, far more important things than being jealous of your neighbor. And if you'd rather live in a cave and some Harrison Bergeron scrap metal hanging off your muscles type of situation than an actual plentiful world with abundance and with rich food and with even the poorest people having cell phones and Netflix, well, then you've got a problem. That's why no one takes the wealth inequality argument seriously. Okay, now let's go to our last two arguments here. Last two arguments against libertarianism are two specific arguments that I need to address here. One's from Ayn Rand and one is from Scott Alexander. Let's do Scott Alexander first. He's the guy, of course, from Astro Codex 10, Slate Star Codex, that guy. Now, normally Scott is absolutely fantastic, but in his essay, what is the title of it? I don't know. It's something against why I'm not, I think it's called why I am not a libertarian or something like that. You can just Google it and it says it. So, oh, you know what? I'll look it up for you. Fine. What is it right here? What's the title of this? The Non-Libertarian Fact. That's what it's called. The Non-Libertarian Fact. Frequently Asked Questions. All right. So where does Scott go wrong here? Well, he goes wrong almost from the very start. So not quite the very start. He does begin with a correct thing, right? He says that a moral system based... I'm going to focus on his moral objections because we've already covered... He talks about the coordination problem and the externality problem, right? Those are his first two sections, and we've already covered those, right? The objection to the externality problem is that this is a violation of people's rights, and that violation of rights needs to be addressed. People that are polluting, people that are dumping negative externalities that violate somebody's rights, those people need to be punished for violating other people's rights, and that takes care of that problem. And the coordination problem, as we discussed, it arises from disparate things, but the point is that the market will be able to work out in conjunction with a properly functioning legal system and advancements in the legal system. It will be able to function, and that just because it's hard, just because that we don't have the solution at hand immediately, doesn't mean that we should give up on allowing it to be attempted, and that we should impose some top-down, exclusive, stifling approach. So that takes care of his first two sections. Now, he's one of the very, very, very few people to address the moral implications of libertarianism and libertarian economics specifically. And it's to his credit that he addresses this, because it is extremely important. So he starts off by saying correct thing. He says moral systems are based only on, that are based only on avoiding force and respecting rights are incomplete. This is true. But that does not mean that libertarianism in the modern sense is such a moral system. And even more to the point, it doesn't mean that there can't be a moral justification of a libertarian society. This is a complete straw man that he has constructed here, right? Libertarianism is a consequence of morals. It is not congruous with or identical to a moral system. And by him saying so, by Scott saying so, is really setting up a straw man argument. It's like saying that a moral system that is based only on eating peanut butter and jelly is incomplete and insufficient. Well, that's true. And therefore, eating peanut butter and jelly is not morally justified. What? What? Just because you can't base a moral system only on eating peanut butter and jelly doesn't mean that you can't morally justify eating peanut butter and jelly. It doesn't follow. Complete non sequitur here, right? Then he commits, all right, so what? Listen, I watched Hubie Halloween last night, right? So I'm going to say it. Then he commits a major boner in his next statement. If you haven't seen Hubie Halloween, right, he thinks boner means a mistake. So he commits a mistake in his next sentence. He says that a more sophisticated moral system is consequentialism. Ha, 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 I say to that. Consequentialism is really like a high school level moral system. And we're going to have to wait for another podcast where we get into the true critique of consequentialism versus deontological systems. Let's move on to the next part, but just pointing out that consequentialism is hardly a sophisticated system at all. I mean, it is compared to like middle school morality or grade school morality, but it is hardly college level or grad school level morality, despite what people like Singer would say and things like that. All right. So let's go on then to the more germane parts of his argument here. So Scott goes on to say he's trying to justify the use of force by the government here. He's trying to justify one group of people interfering with the market and using force on other people, on innocent people, in fact. And he begins this by saying, well, look, people don't value freedom infinitely. Okay, sure, that's true. He says people will make trade-offs in their freedom. For example, people that live in New York maybe could be freer if they were in Montana, but they don't want to leave New York because they have friends and family there. They have other reasons for staying there. So they trade off the slightly more increased freedom they could have in Montana against the value of being near friends and family. Sure, this is true. But then he makes an uncharacteristic error, right? Scott is usually fantastic, but here he commits a major boner, as I was saying, and he says that, well, because people are willing to make this trade-off, that justifies someone else making that trade-off for them. Again, that just doesn't follow. Because I'm willing to live in New York and not Montana for the sake of various family concerns, that does not mean that someone else is justified making other decisions about my freedoms and my rights for me. It just doesn't follow. It's just completely illogical here from Scott, and like I said, very uncharacteristic. He also betrays his ignorance, by the way, of the nature of freedoms, and at least is how they're seen within the libertarian framework, and he does purport to be working within the libertarian framework here, or at least understanding it, when he talks about trading away his freedom to steal, right? You don't have a freedom to steal. That is not a freedom. As I said earlier, freedoms are properly construed as freedoms from things, freedom from interference, freedom from someone taking your property. You never have. There is never a freedom to do anything to someone else like that, much less stealing. So trading away the freedom to steal, when Scott Alexander says that, it just sort of points out that he doesn't really get what he's talking about from a libertarian point of view. And he goes on to say some more silly stuff. He says taxation is theft, but calling it theft is a semantic trick because that makes it sound bad. And really, this sort of theft is just taking without permission. And, you know, it's in this case, it's okay to take without permission, and we shouldn't call it theft, because when you call it theft, you're just trying to capitalize on negative connotations. He says real arguments aren't about connotations. They're about good or bad consequences. So again, he's going full consequentialist here. Listen, if you're going to go full consequentialist here, you have to deal with the omelas problem, right? You have to deal with the human sacrifice problem. Because if all that matters are the consequences of an action, then it's okay to sacrifice a human, you know, torture a human, as long as that leads to good consequences down the line. However, you're measuring consequences. And, you know, apparently Scott and the government and who whatever state would be enacting this scenario, they would assume that they know perfectly well what the consequences of their actions are. The idea of uncertainty doesn't enter into their calculations, or if it does, it enters in some sort of quantifiable way that ignores the possibility of some outrageously unlikely event completely disrupting them, right? The Nasib black swan problem. So, you know, it's just silly. It's just silly to say that consequences are the real root of any argument. In the end, right, we're all going to suffer a heat death in the universe. So it's about the journey, not about the consequences. Consequences ultimately are determined one way or the other. Then he goes on to say it's okay to use force on innocent people, or at least it's okay for a majority to use force on a minority, because there are cases where the consequences are good. And he cites his fishing scenario, he cites his boycott scenario. But the fishing scenario, as I point out, it certainly doesn't prove anything, like he said. You know, he ignored the costs of it. He only looked at the benefits of using force in that situation. He didn't talk about costs like collateral damage or slippery slope arguments or the inefficiencies of adding extra layers to the economy. Ignored all of that. And then he says his boycott scenario that he had discussed earlier proves that using force by the majority against the minority is sometimes necessary. But if you read the boycott scenario that he's talking about, he did, I think, prove that boycotts are usually ineffective. But that doesn't justify using force to accomplish the goals of the boycott, right? Just because something is ineffective doesn't mean, oh, okay, I get to pull out the sword and stab now, right? I tried talking to him, that doesn't work. That doesn't make it okay to just start cutting their ears off. It's just terrible, terrible lapses in logic here. The particular example that Scott was talking about, he's talking about Wanda's horrifying act, this company here, and Wanda had some horrifying act that nobody wanted to see, so everybody was boycotting Wanda. And you know what? Either this breaks down into a negative externality problem, where if Wanda's horrifying act is violating somebody's rights, then that needs to be addressed through the justice system, or maybe that horrific act wasn't so horrific after all. If it's not violating anyone's rights, then maybe the boycott isn't really so necessary. Maybe, in fact, the horrific act that Wanda's committed is something like in the Middle Ages when they started digging up bodies to study anatomy. That horrified everybody, but you know what? It kind of wasn't so bad. It helped advance science, advance society. Genetically modified foods horrified a whole heck of a lot of people, but they're feeding the planet. putting the sun at the center of the solar system. That horrified a ton of people, almost everyone. Evolution horrified almost everyone. But doesn't advancement sometimes depend on putting out some ideas that the status quo will find horrific? And using force against these ideas, doesn't that stifle progress? I think that it does. So, you know, Scott here, he's assuming perfect knowledge. Again, this arrogance, this hubris, a perfect knowledge of what really is truly horrific and what really truly isn't. But assuming that perfect knowledge in order to escape, you know, the principles of a deontological approach and find the exceptions to the principles, that is unjustified. You have not at any point in human history had perfect knowledge, and there's no reason to think that we have perfect knowledge now. People are so in love with their data, so in love with their models, that they can't conceive of them being horrifically wrong. Well, I got news for you. They probably are. They're probably wrong. We have never reached a point of perfect human knowledge, and we certainly aren't there now. For one thing, there's a lot of randomness in the universe, okay? There's a lot of randomness out there. There are more than two bodies in our solar system. We can't even predict, make accurate predictions over the long term about things like that, the bodies in our solar system. So as simple a model as that is, breaks down in the long term, you know, claiming that you have perfect knowledge of every possible consequence is a recipe for failure. All right, the last argument against libertarianism here that we're going to go through is Ayn Rand. She has this famous essay, Why I Am Not a Libertarian. It's an excellent essay, and it's right, or rather it was right at its time. The difficulty here is that the definition of libertarian has changed since Rand wrote that. When she wrote that, right, the libertarian movement really was a protest movement, a counter movement against statism. And as Scott was saying, a moral system that is based only on being against things, and this is Rand's point in the essay too, a system that bases itself on negatives, we're against this, we don't like that. That's not a complete system. You have to have some sort of positivism in there somewhere. You have to posit something. And the thing is, these days, libertarianism does do that. In fact, Rand's objectivist philosophy is pretty close to modern non-anarcho-libertarianism. So the point in her essay holds, but libertarianism, the word, is used to mean far more than what it did back in the narrow days of 60 years ago when that essay was written. All right, folks, so those are the seven arguments against libertarianism and how to counter them. Number one was externalities, and you simply counter that by pointing out that externalities are a violation of someone's rights, and that's the way to address it. You punish people who violate rights. You don't throw out the entire economy. Number two, problems of coordination. And the way to counter that is to say, well, if you're presented with the prisoner's dilemma, you have to allow communication, you have to allow contracting, you have to allow the prisoners to find a way out themselves without these ridiculous external constraints imposed upon them. Or if you're presented with something like the tragedy of the commons and the fish, the overfished lake scenario or something like that, well, then you just point out that, true, if it is public property, common property, you can absolutely develop the tragedy of the commons. That's why it's called the commons. And you need to develop some sort of private system to account for that. And if they say, oh, that's pie in the sky, that's utopia building, you can't do that, that's just too complicated, you say, no, it's really not. And something being difficult is not a reason not to try it. In fact, it's probably a reason to spend even more resources on it and to devote even more time to it, given the track record of land rights. We need to find a way to extend those to air, space, noise, water, heat, things like that. Number three argument was who will protect the workers. And of course, the argument against that is twofold. Number one, states do arguably a much worse job of protecting workers than private concerns do. And the second argument against that is that when you consider protecting the workers, you absolutely have to consider the protection that the workers get from the action of industry itself. There are benefits to the workers from industry as well as dangers, and you have to consider those benefits to the workers as well as the dangers to the workers. Then we talked about the two non-sophisticated arguments, the roads, and of course the roads will get built. That's just silly to say that things like that wouldn't happen if you didn't have the government there to build them. And that goes for anything, weather services, fire departments, anything like that. It's just not a serious argument to say that those won't be built up. There are private weather services right now out there, private weather services right now. And all those needs would be fulfilled if there were no government weather service, for example. Then we did the not very serious argument that the poor will get left behind. That has never been the case in the big picture of things. The poor these days in the most developed countries, they have Netflix and they have cell phones and they eat delicious McDonald's meals. The poor here are not suffering. They have, in fact, far better lives than the rich had 100 years ago. So inequality, you know, is really a pathological argument. Your jealousy, your coveting of your neighbor, that needs to stop. That needs to stop. It's just about overall welfare for everybody. And then we talked about Scott Alexander's objections, and we went to his morality section, and he is a true consequentialist, but we just pointed out all his logical flaws in his arguments there. And then we talked about how the word libertarian has changed since Ayn Rand used it in her I Am Not a Libertarian essay. All right. Remember to subscribe. Remember to find me on Twitter at ADK Homeroom. I will talk to you later, folks. Take care.